become your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Wednesday night, October 15, 2025, as we record this episode. This show starts our 2025 positional reviews for the Chicago White Sox. The upcoming shows will recap what happened in 2025, but we have the intended goal with these episodes of looking ahead to the offseason and brainstorming how can the White Sox improve for the 2026 season. The intended goal is that by listening to these episodes, it helps you, our podcast listeners, with your upcoming offseason plan projects. For this episode, we start with the White Sox bullpen, which we know is going to be an area of focus this offseason as the White Sox relievers blew too many leads this past season. Joining me in this episode is the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It's Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim. I enjoy these positional review episodes every offseason, but before we begin to use this episode as a timestamp, the championship series are still ongoing. Seattle won both games in Toronto. That was a big surprise. Los Angeles won both games in Milwaukee. So the road teams are up 2-0. But as we record this episode, Seattle is absolutely getting crushed right now at home by the Toronto Blue Jays. So it looks like that series is going to be 2-1 in the American League Championship Series. What are your quick thoughts about what we've seen so far from both championship series?
I would say the easier one is the Dodgers-Brewers. You know, the question with the Dodgers is the bullpen, but given that they have all their starters healthy, which has been a problem for them in previous postseason runs, that, you know, can you get to the bullpen? And the Brewers can't right now, and I think as long as that's the case, the Dodgers are in pretty good shape. And you're seeing the Dodgers are pitching so well that they're bringing the 2005 White Sox into the conversation in terms of how few relief innings or outs they're leaving for the bullpen. So that's cool. You know, that's cool to go down memory lane and just see people look at those box scores over again and say, like, how'd that happen? That's never going to happen again. Always a neat little trick. So that's cool. American League is more surprising just because, you know, the Blue Jays not hanging in there against a Mariners team that was put through the ringer by the Tigers. So you would think that there would be, you know, some kind of hangover for Seattle against like a talented team like the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays would be able to exploit at least one of those games, and they weren't. But, you know, there, you are seeing some regression here, and you are seeing the Blue Jays offense wake up. I know that home field is nice in terms of providing the kind of response you want to see from big moments. But we've seen in previous World Series, like the Nationals in 2019, for instance, like nobody winning a home game in that World Series, and home field advantage can be overblown. So the fact that it's 2-1 and that we're seeing offenses step up and deliver some runs, that's a lot of fun. Like I like seeing offenses dictate the action versus everything coming down to managerial decisions. It's been one of my chief complaints of postseason baseball, is everything boiling down to like, what did Dave Roberts do, or what did Aaron Boone do, and so on and so forth, and kind of takes away from the talent on the field. And I think right now with this Blue Jays Mariners series, you're seeing a lot about what the players are doing and which ones are succeeding, which ones are not doing so well. And I think I'd rather have the conversation be that's a lot more enjoyable to me when like players are just creating so much action that the managers can't really keep up, or there's nothing for the managers to do.
Yeah. Right now, as we're recording this, it's the seventh inning. The Blue Jays, who were down 2-0 early after a Julio Rodriguez home run, scored 12 unanswered runs against Seattle. Easy game.
It's a case where like these blowouts are good though for both teams in terms of being able to rest some key relievers. Like I think in a 7-game series, you don't mind losing by 10 runs if you're going to lose, versus like trying to keep it within one or two runs and using relievers you'd rather not use and still not getting the job done. And all of a sudden, you know, that reliever usage chart that we saw a lot on CHSN broadcasts, where you see like a lot of numbers bunched up in red. that's I think what you want to avoid in a World Series if you can. So probably, you know, if you are in the Seattle dugout, you're thinking, well, can save my bullets for higher leverage.
I think Seattle Mariners fans who spent more than $1,000 a ticket to see the first Championship League Series game in Seattle since 2001 may disagree with this, Jim, in that notion. but yeah, so Seattle, Toronto, tons of runs. I did not think the Dodgers had this sixth gear to them because of all the injuries that they had to go through this season. But that's the thing that surprised me in the first two games is like, uh-oh, the Dodgers are back. And as great of a story it would be if Milwaukee got back to the World Series, after the first two games, the Dodgers, I think, proved, even though the Brewers had a better record this season, that the Dodgers are still the team to beat in the National League. And when Blake Snell and Yamamoto are pitching that well, it just feels like it's almost impossible to beat the Dodgers, especially with that lineup that the Dodgers also possess with so much postseason experience.
Yeah. And, you know, there were some questions about the Brewers, you know, can they hit velocity to the extent that's like a real damaging postseason lineup can. And you are seeing that in terms of like five hits over two games and a lot of ground balls, you know, just not being able to lift and really provide that power. And it is, you know, especially talking about like disappointed home crowds. I think, you know, it's been real quiet, just, you know, really hard to string together any kind of rallies. There was that ninth inning. You know, I feel bad for Bryce Terang not being able to get clipped by that pitch. I mean, not blaming him. That's purely instinctual. That's, you know, ball coming at your kneecap. I don't think you can lean into it with your legs the way you can with your upper body. Like you can commit your front shoulder, but you don't hear a lot about like players bending knees into pitches the way that you see like the elbow come out. So that would have been, I think, fascinating if they were able to tie the game and then all of a sudden it's bullpen versus bullpen. And that's been a problem for the Dodgers all along. But I think that's, you know, that opportunity, you know, could, you know, maybe determine the series, just not being able to get one of those games in Milwaukee and still, you know, having, you know, plenty of tough Dodger starters to come. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but, yeah, I think the Dodgers are just so strong and this is what they've paid for. They paid for these starters who don't have to stay healthy the entire season. They've just had a hard time having all the starters healthy at the same time at the end of a season. But I think they're okay, like, you know, having these weird patches where all of a sudden they're calling up Emmett Sheehan and, you know, Bobby Miller not being able to get done is a disappointment. Dustin May not getting able to get it done is a minor crisis. But then, you know, you look at their starters and Snell and Yamamoto and Glasnow and just like, yeah, that's a tough top three.
It is a tough top three. I'm not confident the National League Championship Series goes back to Milwaukee. I don't think they leave LA. I think the Dodgers are going to win the National League pennant. I am more confident that the American League Championship Series will find itself back to Toronto. So that's been a popular question around the nation, the national baseball shows. Which team do you have more confidence could come back and make it a series, Toronto or Milwaukee? I'm going to pick Toronto. I just like the Blue Jays offense a lot more than Milwaukee's offense. And it's Seattle, very green as far as experience. The pressure gets turned up. How are they going to respond? It's just like right now with the Dodgers, can you really put pressure on the Dodgers? Like to your point, the bullpen. If you can get to the bullpen, that's maybe their only pressure point. Defensively, offensively, it just seems like everything's in control. Even that weird play in game one, in which Teoscar Hernandez got thrown out at home on a force play on a ball that hit the center field wall, didn't face the Dodgers. They still won that game, even though that could have been a golden opportunity lost. So Milwaukee, they got a challenge ahead of themselves. Seattle and Toronto, I think we're going to be in for some chaotic performances and games. To your point, Jim, lots of runs, but that makes it a lot more fun to watch.
I think Scherzer starting game four is a bold choice given his age, given, you know, the rocky postseasons he's had of late. Not a great bet. I think, you know, they better have a plan in place just to go to the bullpen early with him. I hope it doesn't hinge on that, because I do want to see the series go six or seven, because it's a lot of fun, a lot of action.
Yes, I think Seattle will be up 3-2 heading to game six to Toronto. And that could be the series that goes seven. I think the Dodgers wrap this up by game five against Milwaukee, which would be sad, but that's just how well the Dodgers have been playing this postseason. All right, let's talk about the Chicago White Sox bullpen. Like I mentioned in the intro, the point of this podcast episode when we do these positional reviews is to remember how the unit performed in 2025, but we are inching closer to the offseason. We just got the number from, I think it was a John Heyman who reported that the qualifying offer, Jim, is going to be more than $22 million this offseason, and that's a lot of money. The White Sox don't have anyone that merits getting the qualifying offer, but something to pay attention to around Major League Baseball for pending free agents. That's a pretty high number when it comes to the qualifying offer this upcoming offseason. But with your offseason plan projects, when we do these positional reviews, we're going to brainstorm, and it helps us with our offseason plans as well, of how can the White Sox improve this unit to win more games in 2026? And the bullpen feels like it's going to be a pretty popular area, Jim. The bullpen and the outfield both need to be addressed this offseason. Let's start on a positive note. When looking back in the 2025 season, what did you like about the White Sox bullpen?
That's a tough question. It's because it was pretty rough as a unit. I think there are some individual stories like Jordan Leisure emerging from, you know, kind of 3 months of confidence crushing moments, or moments that could have been confidence crushing. A lot of meltdowns with the shutdowns. If you pay attention to that Fangraph stat, he was among the worst pitchers on the White Sox in terms of win probability added, which tracks a pitcher or hitter's performance in situations where success really, you know, matters in your team's victory, or failure really hurts in your team's losses. And, you know, just the amount of decent setup work he was doing before some crushing blown saves, even if those blown saves came in the seventh or eighth innings, just because, you know, of the way Will Venable managed, could have determined his season, or could have painted him as like just somebody who's only medium leverage, doesn't have what it takes to be a closer. By the end of the season, you know, a couple of noteworthy blown saves, but like that, you know, the last 2 months, like he had two rough outings, which happened to be the only rough outings of the month. And every reliever is going to have burps like that. So that's fine. So that was cool. You know, I think he still can put together a better season, but in terms of just how he grew and developed and weathered some struggles, like that was great. You know, Grant Taylor being in the bullpen was, I think, good for him, you know, good for, you know, what the White Sox needed. We'll see if it's like lasts in terms of, you know, his plans or the White Sox plans for him. So it's hard to say like that was great for the bullpen if he goes back to starting. You know, maybe the only other story I can think of that was just like a success that felt good all around was Mike Vassell. And I think that was partially him being uniquely suited for the role he was cast in of just pitching whenever. You know, the whole Batman thing, very the free spirit, I think, helps in that kind of regard of being ready for anything. You know, saving games, saving the bullpen by throwing three innings, kind of did it all. And I think Will Venable did a good job of rewarding his performance while realizing like this is not typical high leverage stuff. He doesn't miss that many bats. Our defense is not that good. We're not going to count on him closing too many times, but in the event when our typical high leverage guys are gassed, let's throw him a bone and say like, hey, let's, you know, give it a shot, run out there and record the save. And he did, and it worked out. And, you know, I think Venable did a good job with that closing role of, and this is a departure from Pedro Grifol, of just, he had the guys he wanted in high leverage situations or against the middle of the order when it mattered the most. And that was typically Leisure and Grant Taylor when he arrived, Steven Wilson to a lesser extent. But it wasn't automatic to where if Leisure was in a rut or, you know, Wilson was in a rut, that he'd go there every time and just kind of run them into the ground the way that Grifol did with Kopech and with Reynaldo Lopez. So I think he showed compassion for the relievers and understood, like, a lot of guys are pitching above their pay grade when I asked them to come in and protect a one-run lead in the eighth inning. And did a good job of spreading, you know, fault around to a degree to where the unit felt disappointing, but there wasn't one guy wearing it every time and just being the one who had to walk off the mound, shaking his head or, you know, with a 1,000-yard stare in the dugout because he just gave up three runs to turn a one-run lead into a two-run deficit. I think Venable did a good job in terms of managing the personalities in the bullpen to where, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but it's not because anybody was just, you know, left, you know, hanging out to dry.
The two bullet points that I have, because I also had Mike Vassell, and as you mentioned in previous episodes, the first White Sox reliever to pitch 100 or more innings since Tony Pena did it. And that versatility really helped out when you have your back end of the starting rotation where you may only be able to count on those guys to go four innings. It's kind of nice to have a Mike Vassell that can carry you into the seventh, maybe even to the eighth inning. That really helps you in as long as, like, improving your odds of winning games. But the other two bullet points that I have for the White Sox bullpen, somehow they ranked seventh in Major League Baseball in left on base percentage. They left runners on base at a 73.7% clip. And somehow, according to Fangraphs, the White Sox bullpen ranked 12th in Major League Baseball in terms of WAR. Now, I think that's the case because the White Sox bullpen pitched the second most innings in Major League Baseball this year, one third of an inning shy of tying the Los Angeles Dodgers, who led the majors in how many innings their bullpen had to pitch. But as we just talked about in the championship series, the Dodgers starting pitchers finally got healthy at the right time in October. So, yeah, their bullpen really had to take on the majority of the workload, but that's how you can manipulate your WAR as a bullpen. We pitched a lot of innings, second most, but ranked 12th in Major League Baseball in terms of quality, according to Fangraphs. Let's move over to what we didn't like about the White Sox bullpen in 2025, and I challenge you, Jim, to not say everything else after we just shared what we liked about the White Sox bullpen. Is there anything in particular that you did not like this season?
The lefties were underwhelming as a whole. Just going through all the options, like trading for Cam Boozer and entering the season feeling like he was one of the best high leverage options, that did not come to fruition. Tyler Gilbert was okay. You know, had, you know, a couple stints on the IL, I think, for minor stuff. Versatile, but not somebody who was like excellent leverage. Brandon Eisert certainly took the ball a lot, but was not somebody who could really be counted on for like left on left outs. I think he tended not to get punished, but give him a fair amount of walks up. Speaking of walks, like Frazier Ellard would, you know, I think he's got the best like fastball slider combination, like the lefty, typical lefty arsenal you want against left-handed hitters, but would often like lose a strike zone for innings at a time, you know, outings at a time. So that was, I think, just a constant sore spot. And, you know, the White Sox had one of the higher inherited runner scoring percentages. And I think that was part of it, was just trying to bring in guys for lefty lefty and not getting that lefty out either in the form of a hit or a walk, that all of a sudden that three batter minimum comes into play and you're having a lefty against a righty and then just kind of snowballs.
Yeah. The two bullet points that I have. So I mentioned, according to Fangraphs WAR, the White Sox ranked 12th in win probability added. The White Sox bullpen ranked 28th. In Major League Baseball, only the Washington Nationals and the Colorado Rockies were worse in win probability added when it comes to the bullpen. And the White Sox relievers ranked 29th in Major League Baseball in walk rate. White Sox relievers had a 9.7% walk rate. The Los Angeles Angels were the worst team in Major League Baseball with their relievers walking batters. So obviously, if the White Sox want to win more games, you can't rank 28th in win probability added with your bullpen. And a big factor, as you just mentioned, Jim, with the inherited runner scoring. If you got a runner on second with one out and you walk a guy and then you not walk another guy, well, now it's bases loaded with one out. And the only run that you counts against you is the guys on first and second. And if that runner on third is the only one that scores, that's not on your bill. That's on the starting pitcher's bill, but you still let them score. So that's what we don't like about the White Sox bullpen. You mentioned Will Venable and how that he manages the bullpen. And this is where, when coming up with the offseason plan project, targeting relievers, and maybe if our listeners are trying to be role-specific, that's where I have to start with my marker board or whiteboard exercise, Jim. I don't know if I still have a good understanding after Will Venable's first season and how he wants to use the bullpen, especially the guys that he considers his high-leverage relievers. Is there such a thing as a closer for a Will Venable managed bullpen?
Not yet. And I'm not sure if this is a case where he is just completely open-minded. The bullpen is going to be fluid and there's no such thing as a closer, which, you know, cool if it works. My sense, based on how he managed the season, the amount of chaos in the bullpen early, the fact that the offense, especially in the first half, was not great at tacking on runs to where a one-run lead tended to stay a one-run lead. There were a few games where the White Sox kept adding on and adding on, and all of a sudden medium leverage turned into low leverage. So I think, like, his strategy was, I have to win the inning as it's presented to me. And so you'd see, like, Jordan Leisure come in the seventh inning or the sixth inning. You see Grant Taylor come in the seventh inning or the eighth inning. And then it's like, oh crap, we got one more inning to cover. Couldn't count on that lead getting to the ninth if we wanted, like, Brandon Eisert or Stephen Wilson to come in against the harder lineup. But now it's ninth inning. We're like 9-1-2 and Stephen Wilson's going to be our guy, or, you know, just, you know, Cam Boozer or somebody like that, and turning kind of dicey towards the end. That strikes me as like a defensible approach, because, you know, the alternative is turning to relievers when you know it's not like a great matchup for them. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're bringing in Jordan Leisure with a 2-run deficit versus a 1-run lead when he actually could make a difference. So I can see the thought process. It just doesn't lend a whole lot of insight into how Venable would plan for, like, a bullpen where, you know, he has like the typical two setup guys and a closer, and how he would use that and how he had allocated base and handedness. Right now, it seemed kind of born out of desperation, which, you know, is, you know, I guess desperation, you know, Venable doesn't really lend a desperate air to things. Like, he tends to be pretty even keel in his postgame reactions. Like, you don't see him pacing or chewing gum in the dugout. He tends to be rather placid on the surface. But in terms of just the amount of guys coming in, I think it tended to be just let's throw our best guy or the most appropriate guy at this part of the lineup, and we'll cross that bridge when you get to it in terms of who's going to close. And I don't mind it. It just, when it comes to the White Sox, that they try to be like a 75 win team next year. And if they do try to have a record that matches their Pythagorean record, with one run, yeah, not such an extreme, deficit in their one run game performance, that, we'll have a better sense of, like, is he actually managing the bullpen well versus is he just, you know, trying to do a comb over with just a few hairs on the top of the head.
That's why, with this upcoming off season, with my plan on helping the bullpen and helping Will Venable, Jim, I'm not going to go out and advocate the White Sox spend closer money to sign a closer. If Venable right now needs, to your point, his bullpen to be more fluid, because he just doesn't have enough high leverage guys to begin with. And I mentioned closers because, as we've talked about in recent years, Jim, like, closer money is serious cash. Like, you might be spending $13, $14 million on just a closer. Yes, they are proven that you get the ball to them in the ninth inning and they're going to close out, I'm going to throw a number out there. They're going to get 38 saves out of 42 save opportunities, for example. That's someone, yeah, you want to give that reliever $14 million because you can count on them. But to your point, the White Sox offense was mostly inconsistent in 2025. You don't know if you're going to ever be in that position that many times going into the season. I think the White Sox are 25 for 49 in save opportunities this year. Like, I could see the case to be made that you should spend $14 million on a closer, but I think with the quality of bullpen the White Sox currently have, and we'll go through that exercise in a moment here on the podcast, I think it might be off spending $5 million on, like, two relievers, give them $5 million each, not saying the Joe Kelly, Kendall Graveman path, but if you can find two more Jordan Leisures to add to this bullpen, that might make Will Venable's life a lot easier managing high leverage or even medium leverage situations next season. And that might be a better, bigger benefit for the White Sox money-wise, more bang for their buck than to sign a $14 million closer.
Yeah, I will say when it comes to like team save opportunity stats, like I don't necessarily, you know, it's bad, 25 of 49, worse in the league. But it's always a disappointing number because save opportunities, like if a guy blows a lead in the seventh inning, that's theoretically a blown save.
Yes.
So, yeah. It, you know, you look at like the Rays had a 55% save opportunity or save conversion rate. The top was the Astros at 73%. So it's always a disappointing number. So I think the fact that the White Sox, you know, they had their share of ninth inning blown saves and you know, uncertainty at the end, had people harping on that number a little bit, but I like raising awareness that not all save opportunities are created equal, or guys are credited with blown saves for games they're never going to get the save for, as is the case with like a guy coming in with inherited runner and two outs in the seventh inning and giving up like a run on an error. That's a blown save. So it's a tricky stat for, I think, much beyond guys coming in, you preordained closers coming in to save games in the eighth or ninth inning. But yeah, it's not a, we've seen the White Sox do this before, like David Robertson.
Sure.
Liam Hendricks is kind of similar, but I think David Robertson is like the jumping the gun on getting a closer before you have an offense that's good enough to get him leads to save games. And so they are not at that point yet. And I think they're more in the market of just collecting interesting arms. I think they can use a setup guy, you know, like Joe Kelly, that kind of investment. You're talking about like $8 million or so, a couple years. Not terrible, just because like if is somebody who can potentially close and hasn't been given the opportunity, cool. If it's somebody who can just absorb some tough outings and give Venable like a veteran ballast in the bullpen to where either they're showing the ropes or just somebody who, if he fails two games in a row, you're not worried about their well-being or their mindset. So I think there is always a defense for having one significant bullpen investment, but yeah, signing the closer, you know, paying top closer money, not quite there yet.
So one pitcher for the White Sox that I think will get some consideration if there is ever, if you're ever going to put the label on someone to be the closer, would be Grant Taylor. However, Jim, when it comes to the spring training, should we and fellow White Sox fans be mentally prepared to hear stories in early February that the White Sox may entertain the idea of trying to move Grant Taylor back to becoming a starting pitcher?
They could, just because they haven't closed the door on it. And I figured that they might at this point, if they were dead set on it, like there'd be no point in like floating the idea of him starting if he pitched well enough in the bullpen. Even though I think he, you know, he was learning how his stuff worked in short stints, had some bad luck. You know, James wrote extensively about it, just because he has so many pitches and he's not used to deploying them one inning at a time in high leverage situations. He, you know, up until this point, he was used to more, you know, getting a whole arsenal and really sequencing. And now it's just a matter of like, which two pitches work the best together and you know, use that for 15 or so pitches for this one night, and that's all you have to worry about. And towards the end, like he had a cluster of kind of shaky outings or bad luck outings, as you'd call it. But like at the end of the season, I think he was in good shape. Certainly the peripherals and expected stats loved him. So I think there's a lot to go off of here to where, like, if they wanted to commit to Grant Taylor being a reliever, I think they probably would have said it by now. Perhaps Taylor would like one good opportunity to start. And you know, perhaps his representation would like that. And so maybe that's why they're keeping it open. I am surprised though, a little bit, that it's just like the urgency of moving into the bullpen and starting his clock and the service time. And then like for a team that didn't need him, for a team that, you know, it didn't make a difference really. You know, made some difference versus them, like probably they'd be like a 54-win, 55-win team if they had to go with the bullpen that was not that Grant Taylor was like responsible for that many wins by himself, but I could just see a lot more sloppy or late inning situations without the kind of strikeout power that he presented at the end of the bullpen, because there wasn't really anybody comparable to step in his place. You are going from like above replacement level to like below replacement level to where there's really a big gap there. But with Crochet, like when they did it with him, like he wasn't a good reliever and he wasn't happy. He's like, he didn't seem to respond well to it. And so they were approaching the end of his team control period. So yeah, why not have him start? Certainly won't hurt his value the way like his, yeah, he wasn't building a whole lot of value with relief. So why not try it? And it worked out better than anybody could have possibly imagined. Here, it seems like they're just kind of shy about having him start. We've heard Bannister talk about the injury concerns with the extension he has. And he certainly strained the lat his first year with the White Sox trying to come back from Tommy John surgery. So there is evidence to that. So I am surprised they're keeping it open. So you can't rule it out, the fact that they haven't ruled it out.
Yeah, I'm worried about that shoulder. And I'm worried about the injury risk here. Then again, they have a good case study with Garrett Crochet and how well that worked. And we know that the White Sox could use some help when it comes to the starting rotation to have more frontline starters as they still wait for Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith to make their arrival to the majors to give Shane Smith some help in the starting rotation. So I understand on paper why the White Sox would entertain this idea, because, I mean, it is a 100-mile-per-hour fastball with Grant Taylor and either that slider or curveball that he wants to go to.
And a changeup he's been working on as well.
Yeah, I just don't know if the changeup is advanced enough yet that you can count on him to be a starter. I am a bit concerned as far as his workload and his shoulder. Can he make the start every fifth can give you next season? These are a lot of questions. But for a project, if you do have right now Taylor as like your closer or in the bullpen, just be prepared that come February, the White Sox may change their mind and they may actually try to extend Taylor out to see if he can start some games. Now let's take a look at what we think the White Sox current 8-man bullpen looks like. So this exercise here is taking it from Roster Resource, a valuable resource on Fangraphs.com, and taking a look at the other pitchers in the 40-man roster for the White Sox, maybe some guys that are currently not on the 40-man roster that you would be willing to put on. Right now, as we're recording this, the White Sox 40-man roster is down to 35 guys at the moment as the White Sox are freeing up some space, getting ready for this upcoming offseason. And what Roster Resource has as far as their 8-man bullpen projected for the White Sox, Jordan Leisure, Mike Vassell, Winkelmann Gonzalez, who pitched well for the White Sox, not that many outings, but I thought he pitched well. Brandon Isert, Tyler Gilbert, Steven Wilson. We talked about him in a previous episode with arbitration salaries. He's one guy that I'm already highlighting that I don't know if he would be on my marker board for a projected bullpen in 2026. Brian Hudson, another lefty. And Roster Resource has Jonathan Cannon. I'm not so sure about that. So that's what they have for the Roster Resource for the 8-man bullpen for the White Sox right now. When you hear these names, Jim, out of these eights, Do you have a number, or are there any specific guys that you heard as I was reading off the list that you're like, I'm with you, Josh. I don't think that I would put them on my 8-man projected bullpen right now for the 2026 White Sox.
Yeah. Cannon doesn't seem like a reliever. I think of anything like Sean Burke might be somebody who has relief type stuff in shorter bursts. Don't think they're ready to do that yet either. But if they somehow had like a surplus of starters and Burke is his usual, you know, up and down self, then you know, perhaps they look at his fastball and his curveball, the fact that he has like a two pitch arsenal. And really the problem with Burke is that, you know, he kind of has a two pitch arsenal, fastball, curveball that he tries to get through five innings at a time with. If he had to only do it one or two innings, he might be a weapon. You know, I think when hitters don't get multiple looks at that fastball curveball combination, they have a harder time with it. So I don't mind that idea, but right now, you know, just you have to place them in the rotation and see what shakes out when it comes to who they add, you know, who's healthy given the spate of Tommy John surgeries that they had last spring. You can't rule out a similar just eradication or decimation of the pitching depth to where, you know, every starter who can start must be in the rotation. So he's an option, but yeah, I would say like Gonzalez, I think, showed enough to where if he comes into spring training throwing strikes, the fact that he's hard to hit hard makes him somewhat interesting. You know, Vasil Leisure, you know, looks good. Eisert certainly threw enough to where like the fact that he didn't lose his job over the course of the season, led the team in appearances, shows that there's some either level of trust or level of appreciation for how often he is able to take the ball. But yeah, lefties I think are wide open. And then you get to like Peyton Paulette off the roster, somebody who,
yeah,
he's pitched enough in AAA and pitched well enough in AAA to where like I think he's going to be added to the 40-man roster over the winter. And then just a matter of like, did you have a good spring? Are you one of the 8 best relievers? You could be in the mix. Whether he sticks right away, I think, is an open question. But he's somebody who throws enough strikes, attacks well enough, has major league pitches to where I could see him being a part of the mix.
I'm glad you mentioned Peyton Paulette because he was one of the bullet points that I had and guys that were not on this projected bullpen that I would add. He averaged 95.1 miles per hour with his four-seamer down in Charlotte this past season. He struck out 29.3% of the batters he faced in AAA. I guess I'm a bit surprised the White Sox didn't give him a shot late in 2025, but if he throws well in spring training, I think he's got an honest chance of making this bullpen. Frazier Ellard and Cam Boozer. I bring these names up, Jim, because I was looking at the Stuff Plus numbers on Fangraphs, and Stuff Plus really likes Cam Boozer's arsenal. Like, his scores on all the pitches that he throws are above 100. So Stuff Plus looks at the way that Cam Boozer throws his entire arsenal as better than league average, but the results clearly were not league average. Is he someone that gets another shot of sticking around in the White Sox bullpen?
He could. You know, he certainly doesn't cost much. Certainly has the arm to where he has the outings that, oh yeah, that's especially against lefties, or if it's like a lefty heavy inning or lefty forward inning. He has real easy innings sometimes because this stuff is legit. I think he, you know, didn't necessarily bounce back from the injury to where like that cost him some time, and then he was kind of used irregularly, didn't look great. So it felt like the second half of the season was more like, let's get this year over with, fast forward, see if you can have a better start to next year and sustain it. But you know, he's also he's gonna be his age 34 season, so it's a case where, you know, if you get hurt, chances are you might get hurt again, because he was such a late bloomer, such a late arrival to the majors, that he's easy to remember. Like, even though he is pre-arb age-wise, he's post-arb. He would have been most pitchers would have hit free agency multiple times over, just because usually if they don't make it by age 26-27, they may not make it at all. And he's a guy broken at what, 32? So yeah, it's different case.
Brandon Eisert might be a case study of how traject hurts him. And this is something that I think we're going to have a future episode about. What, there's been a ton of research already early this off season, and the benefit teams get from using Traject before a game. And I know, you know, Saris has written about this. Others have written about in that the funkier arm angle a pitcher has, the better they're going to pitch at home than on the road, because opposing teams, when they're at home, have Traject and they can see and hit against that weird arm angle. But when they're on the road, they don't have Traject, so they have to rely on video and past experiences, and they're having a tougher time catching up with that throwing angle, and it's throwing them off. I bring this up because, holy cow, Brandon Eisert's OPS against splits, home and away, are gigantic. Overall, pitching at home, opponents had a 733 OPS against Brandon Eisert. On the road, 953. Home games against left-handed hitters, lefties had a 570 OPS against Eisert. That's fantastic. That's what you need at a left-handed reliever. On the road, over 1,000. Left-handed batters and their home ballpark against Brandon Eisert had an OPS over 1,000 against him. So that tells me, as teams are preparing to face the White Sox relievers, knowing full well more than a quarter through the season, Jim, that Eisert is going to be in these games in this series, as you mentioned, you led the team in appearances. Yeah, you're going to load up Brandon Eisert on your Traject machine, and you're going to get some swings at him using Traject, and you're going to have a better feel of his throwing angle, so you'll be better prepared to face him at your home ballpark. And again, a lot more conversation, a lot more research has to go into this. But he is my early case study for the White Sox perspective of a pitcher who gets hurt more when he's got a pitch on the road because the home team has Traject and they're better prepared to face him.
Yeah, I saw that come up, especially with Trey Savage going from dominating the Yankees to getting pounded by just ambushed, flat out ambushed in the first inning. With the high arm angle. Also, there's a strikeout that he didn't get that kind of flipped the inning. But it's especially interesting because, like, that was the White Sox first point of attack for trying to assemble a bullpen, was let's come up with a lot of crazy arm angles. Let's have a lot of unpredictable looks. And teams will have a hard time game planning because they won't exactly know what's coming. And then, like, you know, if this is a case and it sticks, to where teams, at least in their home ballparks with Traject, can do a quick crash course on low arm angles, high arm angles, ball being hidden, et cetera, that all of a sudden that could blow up. And, you know, it is back to being, you know, who's got the best velocity, who just has really hard stuff, hard to elevate stuff, just really hard, boring. Like, you know, Wickelman Gonzalez didn't really get hurt on the road. Walks were his enemy, but just hard time squaring him up when he's in the, like, Dan Altavilla was somebody who just, hard sinkers, you know, not necessarily missing bats, but just the tough stuff that's hard to lift. I think that's something that seems to translate pretty well. Mike Vassell, another case where he performed well on the road because he threw a lot of sinkers and, you know, a lot of good movement, a lot of hard running pitches to help open up the plates. And so I think in lieu of, you know, paying the price for, like, top velocity and just, you know, really powerful, typical fastball slider combinations, you might see more cases to where if they have to fill out a bullpen, you might see more just power sinkers. You maybe not bat missing, but just hard to lift. You know what's coming, but still have a hard time hitting it no matter how much you see it or just how simple the scouting report is.
So on my marker board, when it comes to the White Sox projected bullpen, I got Grant Taylor, I got Jordan Leisure, I got Mike Vassell, I got Winkelman Gonzalez. I liked what I saw from Winkelman Gonzalez. I'm totally going to leave the door open. Eisert's got options. Hudson and Gilbert don't have options, so maybe the White Sox do stick with one or both of those guys in a bullpen. Let's just say I'll just stick with one of those lefties. You have three open bullpen spots, in my opinion, podcast listeners, when you're doing your offseason plan project. I would fill one of those with Payne Paulette, but I think as a good exercise when you're working your offseason plan project, you should find two relievers to add to this White Sox bullpen. And this is where the creativity comes in, And I can't wait to see and who you guys would target as far as those relievers. But are there any, you mentioned hard throwing relievers. Are we looking at relievers that have an average four seam velocity greater than 95 miles per hour, Jim? Is that what you would be looking through for when you're scouting possible free agent relievers?
Yeah, kind of 96 and more would be the idea. And this will be a good question for when the White Sox replace Ethan Katz, the new pitching coach. I think that'll shed some insight in terms of how that affects the players they bring in. I know that Ethan Katz, he had to kind of mix and match and was not gifted with a bullpen teaming with stuff, either velocity or, you know, great movement profiles. So it was hard to say it was his fault. And certainly I think he would love to have more high octane arms over the course of a season. Perhaps the White Sox thought he could work with it, or thought, you know, maybe, you know, he's a guy who can help shape some unorthodox deliveries into something functional. Like Penn Murphy is a guy we haven't talked about, but like he was a part of like that first draft of a bullpen. Let's have these real flat approach angles and, you know, really work at the top of the zone with 90 mile per hour fastballs, and didn't work. So I'm curious, when they're trying to find that pitching coach, does that pitching coach have input into, I'll take this job, but I would like more of this kind of pitcher, or this is the kind of, this is the kind of profile I've had success with. And, you know, once I think that staff's in place, we'll have a better idea of the kind of arms they pursue. Also, the White Sox, you know, I'm assuming they're going to add like Tanner McDougal and Paulette to the bullpen, but or to the 40-man roster. But there really isn't anybody else who's really, you know, maybe Shane Murphy, just because he pitched so well, even though the, you know, the crafty lefties are not necessarily get priority when it comes to the Rule 5 draft. You know, maybe he gets added, but still you're looking at like five or six open 40-man roster spots. So I think you're going to see a lot of waiver claims as well, just as guys get added, guys get released. White Sox saying like, hey, there's a fastball. Let's grab them and see what the idea is. So I think while they are in a position to add a reliever of some credibility and some track record, I think you're also going to see a lot of just random shots on guys who they like in other organizations, just waiting for 40-man roster crunches to come, waiting for, perhaps the Rule 5 draft. They're going to have another high pick in the Rule 5 draft. Maybe that's another way they fill the bullpen spots, is with having a guy they need to carry and liking at least one pitch that he has.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Jim. And that's where I'm excited about the offseason plans this year, is that creativity on targeting guys. I totally spaced out. Yeah, you have to, in your offseason plan project, hire a pitching and hitting coach. That's going to be great. You know, go across the league, maybe even dip into college baseball if there's a pitching coach. Actually, I remember that when we did the offseason plan project, I had a feeling like it was going to be that it was that AJ Hinch season, but they ended up hiring Tony La Russa. But I advocated that the White Sox go after Chris Fetter, the pitching coach in the University of Michigan, Rickon being a Michigan guy, Fetter being, of course, from University of Michigan. And Detroit totally stole my idea. They stole what I did for the offseason plan.
What's the price on Matt Hobbs of Arkansas, given the Paulette connection, you know, given the Hagen-Smith question. Connection?
Yeah, but the thing with Hobbs is that he could be next in line to take over as the head coach of Arkansas.
Yeah.
Like, Dave Van Horn at Arkansas has been teasing the idea that he doesn't have many seasons left. And he is getting up there in age, but nobody really knows that if he's like going to retire in a couple of years. But Hobbs is a great pick. Same thing with Vanderbilt with Tim Corbin. Nobody, I mean, it's assumed that Corbin's going to coach forever, but that really may not be the case. Yeah, for all those that follow college baseball along with me, yeah, target some guys. They have pitching labs now, and a lot of these have experience in developing pitchers to become first round talents. You could even look out east to like Wake Forest, for example, and their amazing track record in developing pitchers to get drafted. This is going to be exciting.
Yeah.
And it is another factor. And when you're trying to repair the bullpen, who's your pitching coach and what is their philosophy and how to try to better this unit?
I think you just run the risk of Wes Johnson leaving the Twins to
coach,
was it Georgia? Did he go from LSU to Georgia? Was that the,
yeah. So he went over to LSU, coached up Paul Skeens, leverage that season to becoming the head coach of Georgia.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, you always run the risk when somebody comes from college that, you know, given the amount of money in the college game, that they could easily go back. I think that would be the one risk if you're trying to establish a pitching apparatus. It would be, you know, Chris Fetter has stayed. So, and you're seeing like AJ Hinch just got extended. So it really seems like they've prioritized that arrangements with, Hinch and Fetter, and giving them a lot of leeway with how pitchers are developed and what arms they bring in. And you know, they're doing a pretty good job, I think, especially the bullpens. It was bullpen last year, starting this year in terms of where they've had successes. I think they kind of maybe relied on the bullpen abilities a bit too much in terms of coming up with relievers out of nowhere. You kind of saw them run out of gas towards the end of the season because of the amount of stress that they had to take on with the offense not performing, but it does seem like it's working for him with Fetter. So wouldn't mind seeing that name at least. Even if it's hard to pry somebody away from a college program like that, just seeing that they're thinking of it.
You know, it's not a terrible idea. Actually, the more I think about it, I do think the White Sox should interview Matt Hobbs just to get more insight and maybe just have a lengthy conversation about Hagen Smith, because that is going to be pretty key for whoever does take over the White Sox pitching coach responsibility of trying to get Hagen Smith back on track and be more consistent. That'd be worthwhile just to have the conversation. But the thing about, like, if you're a college pitching coach, you mentioned Wes Johnson, the college game is more forgiving in accepting you back than the major. So if there's ever a college pitching coach on that scale, like Matt Hobbs, and if there's ever a real opportunity to become a major league pitching coach, they may want to try it to see if they can do it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. They can always come back to the college game. And then every major college program knows, oh, Matt Hobbs, he's phenomenal as a pitching coach. It's the majors. You know how they are. And you got divas. Oh, we'll totally take Matt Hobbs back. You know, we'll give him $400,000 to be our pitching coach for one of our elite programs. So it's not a terrible idea. You may be able to away from Arkansas, but again, like I mentioned, with Arkansas's current situation, he may be next in line to becoming Arkansas's head coach. But yeah, can't wait to see what you guys suggest as far as White Sox pitching coaches, and can't wait to see what you guys do in the bullpen. Again, as Jim and I mentioned, sure, you can add Payne Paulette to the White Sox bullpen, but with your offseason plan projects, you probably should have at least two relievers that you're adding, whether that's Rule 5 draft, whether that's through waiver claims, free agency, or even trades to the 2026 bullpen. We hope this episode helps you walk through the decisions that you have to make with the White Sox relievers, as that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at the White Sox starting pitchers and see where the White Sox can improve on that front. There's going to be so many starting pitchers coming back from injury. We also have some movement on the outfielders. So catchers and outfielders is going to be its own episode. And the final one is going to be infielders, as that seems to be a little bit more set for the White Sox. But you definitely have some big decisions to make on the pitching front and in the outfield front, and those will be our upcoming episodes. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch our show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the social media platforms at Sox Machine. James is on vacation, but you can still follow him at JR Fegan, and you can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, sign up to become a Sox Machine subscriber at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5, and that gets you the ad-free version of both the podcast and the website. Also unlocks the comment section for you. We have additional tiers of support as well, including our Veterans Committee. Our VC members get to be put into a group chat and have direct access to both Jim and James. Great way, if you have questions on your mind, you can pester James and James can go find out for you. And James also is willing to share a little bit of gossip, maybe that he doesn't report, but he'll share the whispers and the rumors in the group chat. If that's of interest to you, you can inquire within at SoxMachine.com/products. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.